Okay, so here's our beloved black hole with its no drama horizon, and where you have to go well within to reach some drama in the form of strong gravity. So a not quite black hole is where the strong gravity comes all the way out to just beyond the would-be horizon. And I'm saying would-be because this object does not have a horizon, it's horizonless. And this strong gravity extends just a very small distance, delta r, characterized by the Planck length. So it's for that reason that this object is extremely close to being a black hole, but not quite. So in particular, just outside this delta r region, you go exponentially fast over to the Schwarzschild solution. So why am I talking about not quite black holes? Well, I think it's related to this question. Does a UV complete theory of gravity permit some other endpoint of gravitational collapse? And I'm claiming the answer is yes, because one needs only to turn to an action quadratic in the curvature to find these not quite black hole solutions. And quadratic gravity is in fact an old candidate, and maybe the first candidate for a UV complete theory of gravity. As we've just been hearing, its quantum version is renormalizable and asymptotically free. It had issues, well-advertised issues, but people are rethinking these things and the conclusions may differ from in the past. Okay, so in that particular theory, we find these solutions I'm talking about, and we call them tutu holes. And recently, I found these tutu hole solutions that are sourced by an ordinary relativistic gas. Now, in this talk, it's not about the theory of tutu hole solutions. And I just want to say a few things about them, though. So these objects have a well-defined and easy-to-calculate entropy that is somewhat larger than the entropy of the same-size black hole. And for that reason, then, they may be the preferred endpoint of gravitational collapse. So, yeah, I'm saying that there are no black holes in nature. Black holes are a solution of this particular theory, but there's another whole class of solutions, these tutu holes, in some sense more generic. They're described by more parameters than the black hole solutions are. So tutu holes come in two types. The large ones, and they have no upper limit on their size, just like black holes. But they also come as the smallest ones, which are Planck size. And the inner structure of these two things are quite different. Now, as far as the large ones go, different interiors for two different size tutu holes are just related by a simple scaling relation. So in fact, all the big ones are basically the same. Now, this situation is not completely unlike QCD. Of course, we have the hadrons of fixed size coming out of QCD, but there are also these quark matter states in QCD, and they have variable size, and they can extend up to something like a neutron star size, where finally gravity comes in to put an upper limit. So this is just showing that you can have the effects of strong gravity extending over macroscopically large regions. In this example from QCD, and so I'm just saying, why not gravity? Yeah?
Just to understand, are you suggesting these tutu holes as a new breed of black hole-like objects?
Yes.
Or
no.
Are you claiming that all black holes should be thought of as tutu holes?
I'm suggesting that all black holes are actually tutu holes, or something like tutu holes. Yeah. I'm just going to call them not quite black holes. I think there's that idea that you can have macroscopic objects involving strong interactions over very large distances is might be the reason why this has not been considered very much. So I'm just bringing up this analogy here.
Sorry, one question. Is it true that for the large ones, the role of the R squared corrections is small, but R squared depth is small, whereas for the small ones, it's important.
No, they're important for both.
For both.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, there are solutions for which they are important. I mean, I guess that's the statement.
Like the Weyl squared term is the essential term in the quadratic action. And that's the term that has the ghost that we've been hearing about. So that is the essential term. And that has these strong effects. So yeah, this isn't a talk about all that theory. I want to get it to data, surprisingly. I want to look at LIGO data. So we want to be talking about gravitational waves. So let's just start, first of all, with the scalar wave equation, just around a short-shelled background. And using tortoise coordinates, the wave equation can be characterized by a potential. And that potential is nothing but a potential barrier, a so-called angular momentum potential barrier, around the light ray. And we can choose the origin of our tortoise coordinate to be zero at that point. So in these coordinates, then, to go in towards the horizon, you have to go off to minus infinity to reach the horizon. So that's the black hole picture. But for these not quite black holes, waves have a finite travel time to the origin. So if we want to modify that picture to take that into account, there's some kind of boundary or wall at a finite negative tortoise coordinate. So then, along with our potential barrier, we have a cavity. So we have a cavity structure here with some size, we call it delta x, and some round travel time in the cavity. Delta t is just 2 delta x. That's another simple property of using tortoise coordinates.
Are these singular?
You're talking about 2-2 holes?
Whatever you're using.
Yeah, okay, the 2-2 holes solutions have a time-like singularity. And you're going to see the effect of that soon, okay? And I would end up calling that singularity a very benign singularity.
But they don't have horizon, because
that's... Yeah, we've traded a horizon in for a time-like singularity just at the origin. So if we want to compare a few objects here, what we just showed there, you could just call a truncated black hole, much like TIFF's brick wall model from long ago. If we want to compare it to a compact star, you would find it differs at the origin. It has an angular momentum barrier right at the origin. And then turning to a 2-2 hole, it's much more similar to the truncated black hole. So this is why I'm saying we were talking about a singularity, but this is the effect of the singularity. In the wave equation, there's basically no effect of the singularity. This tiny structure here corresponds to the interior of the 2-2 hole. And the rest of this distance is coming from the radius just slightly outside the would-be horizon.
But the other thing is that this x is finite. It doesn't go to minus infinity. It's
not. In all these cases, yeah. So by looking and comparing the red and the red and the black, we say that the truncated black hole is not a bad approximation to a 2-2 hole. On the other hand, a 2-2 hole like a star has an origin instead of a wall. So when I say wall in this talk, it could either mean the wall of a truncated black hole or the actual origin of something like a 2-2 hole. So this cavity structure is what we're going to try to probe experimentally. So the effect of radial description of low frequency waves is that of a 1D cavity with one end, the potential barrier, is slightly leaking. So a pulse, say a gravitational wave pulse moving back and forth in the cavity, will produce a periodic pulse, the so-called echo, on the outside, which is the nice observation by Cardoso and Penny. But what if the perturbed state of the newly formed black hole? So I'm talking about the thing formed after the merger of something that LIGO has seen. So that object, in the instant it's formed, is in some perturbed state. And what if it doesn't just give rise to a simple pulse that ends up going back and forth? So in that case, there might not be a simple echo structure. Well, I'm saying that's okay, because a 1D cavity has a more general feature than an evenly spaced resonance. Well, yeah, it has a more general feature, which is an evenly spaced resonance spectrum, where the spacing between the resonances, delta F, is just 1/2 the size of the cavity, or 1/(Δt). So people have been talking about echo searches, but I think we should be talking about resonance searches. Well, let me just stick to the simplest case, so a simple pulse moving back and forth. Here I'm also claiming the simplest waveform is quite complicated. So here's an example. I'll get to this example later. But these are the first 5 echoes with the time between the echoes taken away. And you see each echo is quite different from the others, quite non-trivial. So of course, this is going to be harder to model than the original merger waveform that LIGO used to make its discovery. But LIGO likes to use the technology it has, so it has had a few echo searches, and this is a recent one where they're trying to use their match filter technology. So they use templates, in this case, generalized sine Gaussians, each with 9 parameters, and this is one example. In this search, they say they use a superposition of n such waveforms. So they have a large number of parameters. And if you're using templates with a large number of parameters, then whatever you're searching for is you're gonna have a lower sensitivity to that by some factor like the square root of the number of parameters. So I'm not sure this is the way to go. Just another way to say it is irregular echoes are easy to lose in the noise. So here are our first 5 echoes again. And let's just add enough noise to make it hard to see that there are echoes. So this is signal plus noise. We can take the Fourier transform and the absolute value. Again, nothing much to look at. Well, let's consider longer time frames. So the green again is the signal plus noise, and I've given in the red the actual signal on top. So if you go to 50 echoes, you can see the separate echoes, but they start to merge after a while, like after 30 echoes or something. So even in the simplest possible case, the simple echo structure disappears after a while. If you go to 150 echoes, the signal seems to be decreasing, so it looks hopeless. It's going to be more and more swamped by the noise. But if you now look at the absolute value of the Fourier transform, something is peaking up above the noise. So what's going on there? Well, these are the sharp resonances of that cavity, and they're so sharp that you have to have enough time to get enough resolution to see those sharp resonances. If you go in even longer times, then even that will start to go away. So depending on what your waveform is, there's going to be some optimal number of echoes to be looking for these things. Okay, so we're considering gravitational waves on a truncated Kerr background, and we'll focus on this one mode, the so-called dominant L equal M equal 2 mode. So even so, it's a complex amplitude. So we can... concentrate on this time-dependent function, our waveform, and it's complex. So when we consider the Fourier transform of that, call it psi omega, it's not going to be conjugate symmetric around omega equal to 0. So we're going to have to consider that thing for both positive and negative frequencies. Now, the psi omega object is theoretically where we get what we calculate. And in my case, I choose to use the so-called SN equation, which is a solution as a function of omega and x. And taking this limit, I can extract psi omega. So that's the story then. We get psi omega first, and then from that, we'll get the waveform in time. And if we go through that exercise, we'll see the origin of that complicated looking five echoes that I showed you. And we'll also see some further dependence on initial conditions. So if it isn't such a simple pulse moving back and forth, then things can get a lot more complicated. Okay, so at this point I decided, well, I'll reorganize the talk. I'm going to move that section later, and I want to sort of cut to the chase and get to the data sooner than later. Okay, so what is a LIGO detector doing to this complex waveform? Well, depending on the orientation of the detector, it's going to project out a set of real numbers. So this, and that's the strain data. So for us, we have to take our waveform, this complex waveform, and do the similar projection. And we'll just do the real part. Different projections do give different results, but they're all qualitatively the same. So from what I've been saying then, to search for this resonance pattern, we choose some time duration starting just after the merger. We take the fast Fourier transform. We take the absolute value. So we have to carry out these steps on this complex waveform that we're getting theoretically. And then we end up with something we call the reconstructed psi omega. So it's not the original psi omega. It's the psi omega that is accounting for the fact that we're doing this projection and we're considering a finite time. Okay, so then that reconstructed psi omega will depend on NE, which is the time, the number of echoes, as well as the mass and the spin and delta T. So here's an example of this reconstructed psi omega, the absolute value part. So yeah, I've gone to 180 echoes, a spin of 2/3, 50 solar masses. And this ratio, there's the dm there is actually gm, so that's a dimensionless ratio. And you see it's a large number. So I'll get to that later, why it's such a large number. Well, I'll mention it now that there's a log involved, a log of the mass of the object over the Planck mass. So yeah, in this sense, LIGO is probing the Planck scale. Okay, now if you look at this, I think you can see that there's actually two components, and there's this component that looks something like this. And the origin of that is actually the original negative part of the original psi omega. So after doing that projection, we end up talking about something only for positive frequencies, and it has this two-component structure. Okay, so I'm saying this is a resonance search. All other echo searches try to model the full waveform. And in our notation, in frequency space, the full information is in this reconstructed version of the absolute value, plus the phase of the reconstructed psi omega. And if you want to look at the phase, this is what it looks like, a mess. So I'm saying that all these other echo searches, using some kind of template, effectively have to reconstruct this mess, or it's likely they're going to fail. Okay, so we're going to stick with our absolute value of this series in frequency space. And we've just seen the spectrum, those bunch of spikes which extend over a certain range of frequency. So we're going to apply a bandpass. So now we've got this bandpassed object. We multiply by a uniform comb structure. So we're trying to pick out those sharp resonances. So we're going to multiply by a uniform comb structure. So it has a spacing, an overall shift. Okay, now I'm starting to deviate from our original published analysis of this type because I'm now choosing a completely uniform comb. So I'm simplifying the analysis. Okay, so yeah, we multiply by this comb, we average over the non-zero values. That's some kind of amplitude. We have an amplitude from each detector. And then we take those amplitudes and search for a correlated enhancement for some particular spacing and shift. So I'm going to go through each event, and I'm going to group them in this way. So depending on whether their spins are closest to 2/3 or 0.72 or 0.81, this 0.81 is the central value of that, of the spin of that final object. Our wall has to do with the boundary condition, either at the wall of a truncated black hole or at the origin of a not quite black hole. This is in the part of the talk that I put later, but basically this is close to being a Dirichlet boundary condition. And this last row has to do with the initial pulse. Remember, I'm still sticking with the simplest possible case of just a simple pulse moving back and forth. And I can characterize that pulse by how much of the energy of that pulse is at negative frequencies. And you can see it's a fairly small amount.
So were that those 0.5 and 1 things?
Oh, yeah, okay. So this is a more technical point about whitening the data, which is very important in this analysis. So to whiten the data, you first have to calculate the PSD. To do that, you need a large number of segments you're going to average over. I use 300, but there's a parameter here. How long is each segment? It turns out choosing that segment to be either 0.5 seconds or 1 second helps to, for some reason, account for different noise characteristics of these events. This 0.8 should actually be 1, but in that case, the data was not complete, so I'm forced to use 0.8. So, okay, so there is a binary choice I'm making. But there are other parameters in the whitening, and all those parameters are the same for all events. And in fact, the whole analysis for every event is completely identical now. Yeah?
Can you tell us what windowing you did in order to...
Those are Hanning windows?
Hanning windows.
Yeah. Not Hanning.
Hanning.
Yeah. And I have some overlap and padding. Both of those things are turned on. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So completely the same analysis for each event. So yeah, our object here is try to pick out the optimal spacing of that comb, and that would give us the, if there is a signal, that tells us delta t. So what we're doing is expressing this spacing delta f as an integer, so delta f in units of 1 over t is what I'm saying. It should be an integer. It's also just t over delta t. So okay, so that's just what we're going to plot things with respect to. We plot the correlation I mentioned between the two detectors and then look for a peak. So again, the critical thing we're varying and trying to find the right value for is delta F or delta T. But we can choose to vary both of these things at the same time and keep the peak at, to sit right at a particular n, which from what we just said here would correspond to a particular number of echoes in that time. Okay, so that's the basic procedure, but then we want to optimize things. And the analysis here optimizes over three quantities. The value of this NE, like where do we place the peak, or how many echoes are we going to include, going back to those original plots I showed you, in that case, something like 150 echoes would be a good choice. Well, we're going to have to decide from the data what is the best choices for NE. And the other thing we're going to decide from the data is the frequency bandpass. So I'm adjusting the high and low values of the frequencies to optimize the signal.
But you know, these are all free parameters, so they could give you Lukacs-Sperre effects. You have to, I mean, whenever you make these choices in the data, when you estimate your p-value, you should also
Well, them. We're going to look at these bandpasses and compare them to theory.
Okay. If you compare it to theory, then that's different.
Yeah, that's the whole point. So I'm going to take the bandpasses completely data-driven, and then I can compare to the spectrum you looked at. And that spectrum, those spikes, extend over a certain range of frequency. And that's a theoretical quantity, depending on these various measured quantities, which change for every event. So I think it's somewhat non-trivial if these two things line up. So we're going to go through each event now and see how that works. So here's the first event. And the red, or whatever color that is the bandpass. And you see the spectrum with the parameters of this event going into that. You see the PSDs for the two detectors. And of course, the normalization is doesn't mean anything, so just ignore it. So in this case, the spectrum and the bandpass are somewhat consistent. So in each event, I'll give you the NE, which I say is where the peak is located. And for each event, you have the delta T, which is precisely given because we have many sharp resonances, all evenly spaced. So we have to choose the spacing of that comb very accurately to optimize the signal. So that's why this, if there is a signal, then we're going to know this time delay very well. But physically, this ratio is more interesting, where again, M has a factor of G in it. So this is dimensionless, and it's one of these large numbers.
What are you plotting here in the bottom?
The plot is the correlation between the two detectors as you change the spacing between the teeth of the comb.
Okay. And what is capital T and?
T, big T is the total duration of the data that you're choosing.
So that's a fixed number.
You can say in this case that T is held fixed, delta T is now varying, and therefore generating different numbers. This range is actually quite large. It's like 40% above and below the central value. So I am testing for many different choices of the spacing of the teeth.
So in this, you're starting right after the event.
Yeah.
And how long a record do you use?
Well, 200 times this.
Okay. 5 seconds.
Okay. And yeah. Did you do similar analysis against just noise? No. We have many samples of noise that are well away from
the detector. Sure, that's the type of thing you do for getting a p-value. And we spent time on that in our first analysis. But I haven't calculated p-values here. I'm just trying to show you some interesting features of the data, which would then have to go into some kind of global p-value, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the issue is, or the question is we've got noise in this plot, and any noise is going to have peaks in it. And so the question is the peak just a noise artifact?
Yeah. Well, let's just continue and see. Yeah. So you, as I go through these events, each event has a different final mass for the object. And that basically tells you the range of frequencies that we're ending up looking at. And again, this bandpass was data driven. So whatever noise you're talking about, whatever detector effects you're worried about, would have to do something different for a different frequency range for every event, okay? By looking at this plot, you can tell which signals are somewhat stronger than others. So I'm going through all the events that are closest to spin 2/3. And I think you're seeing that it's quite a good match between the data and the theory.
Sorry, how can you see that?
The bandpass, this limit and this limit. If I move this limit up or down, this peak goes down.
Are you saying the bandpass is where you have the biggest?
The bandpass is, yeah.
The biggest signal, okay.
Biggest signal, so it's completely data-driven. And the spectrum is theoretical, depending on those measured parameters. And I'm just saying, yeah, if this bandpass was way over here somewhere, it wouldn't be consistent. But it seems to be including.
The range of the LIGO noise is as small as probably, isn't it?
The normalization of the LIGO noise means nothing, okay? Of course, the signal doesn't spike up above the noise like that. The noise should be way up here, and we're just trying to pick out, by this analysis, these very sharp peaks, but not strong peaks. This is one of the more recent events. Okay, now.
Sorry. Can you go back to the previous one? Your PSD now looks very different in this event. So suddenly all those peaks disappear from the PSD.
So this is one of the more massive events. So it's pulling down all the frequencies. So it's true, yeah, you're looking at a different range of the PSDs in every event.
But there's a significant overlap. So
in
our analysis, I've always seen around 180, there's a significant peak in the PSD. It's from the power line.
So this is a PSD calculated using the data right around this event. So.
By the way, we have less than 5 minutes.
Okay, so let's just go through these 0.72s. So I think you're seeing there's a nice consistency between data and theory. And get to this last event, which is the most interesting. So this is the highest spin event. And what I'm finding here are two signals with two non-overlapping bandpasses. So both bandpasses, both analysis will determine its own delta T, but they turn out to be the same, up to three figures. Then you say, well, why not just choose a larger bandpass that includes both? Well, when I do that, the signal drops quite drastically. But now we go back to the fact that there are these two components. And what these two bandpasses are doing are picking out, this is the original negative frequency part, and separately from the positive frequency part. So So those two parts can have a relative shift with respect to each other. That's a natural thing that can happen here. And that would explain what I'm finding, that a large bandpass wouldn't include both. And both of these signals are quite strong. So I think that's quite interesting. I want to show a summary plot now. So the summary plot is going to show you a value of eta for every event. And this eta enters into this relation between this ratio I've been talking about, this large number like 800, and these quantities m, spin, and redshift. And I said that's the reason why you get something like 100 from that log. Okay, so I'm going to produce a plot for eta for each event. The error bars on the plot are just from the LIGO measurements. Meanwhile, eta also determines this delta r that I mentioned at the very beginning. How far beyond the would-be horizon does the strong gravity extend? And it goes like something like this. So delta r, if eta is between 1 and 2, then delta r is smaller than the coordinate version of the Planck length, or it's larger than the proper version of the Planck length. So that's the summary plot for the value of eta from all 10 events. And it's surprisingly consistent to have a universal value of eta for all events, maybe even too consistent. So it would mean that LIGO is overestimating their errors, maybe? I don't know. But the number for eta I get is around 1.7, which gives these sizes for the delta r. Now this is the same plot as before. I've just extended eta over a much wider range. Now what happens if we take that formula for delta t over m and take away the spin factors, the spin factor and the redshift factor, and just redid the analysis? Then the points would be higher and over 2. So that would be quite unphysical, because then you're saying this delta r is much, much, much smaller than the proper Planck length. And the other thing is this one event, that last one I just showed, happens to have the largest mass, the largest spin, and the largest redshift, all by quite large factors. And so that formula brings it down to agree with everything else.
So sorry, is that most of the source of error from like mass and spin errors? Or?
Yes, it's all just from mass, spin, and redshift.
And do you include the correlation between those errors?
No.
So maybe that's the reason that you overestimate, because there are all lambda correlates to some of those errors. Like for example,
Between events? Between events?
Yeah, between parameters. Because I guess you're assuming we don't know the correlation of the errors, but they're all very correlated with each other.
That could be true, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that's...
So 10 to the 12th time the Planck length, right? That's a magic scale for the black holes.
Yes, yeah. So let me just get to the conclusions. This part of the talk, you would have seen why... Well, let me just look at this. This is the original Psi Omega, and it has this three bump structure, and that's why you had this non-trivial looking waveform. And if you go to more complicated cases, then it gets more complicated. The echoes are more complicated to the extreme where you have a completely random initial condition, no more echoes, but you still have a resonance pattern. So the conclusions, I think, here, the main one is that LIGO is very sensitive to not quite black holes. And this sensitivity to Planck scale physics is underappreciated. And the other conclusion is the signal waveform is very variable and complicated, maybe so much so for the template analysis to handle. Whereas this equally spaced resonance pattern is very robust and easy to search for. And even there, there's this two-component structure to explore. So, okay, I've said all these things, so I'll stop there.
So for usual black holes on the horizon, when they're moderate or large size, we don't have the strong gravity regime right outside the horizon. But so for the Event Horizon Telescope, for example, people weren't able to get a lot from the strong gravity regime by that image. But how does that change for not quite black holes? So, if because in the one of the first slides you had shown the strong gravity regime extends to beyond where the horizon would be.
The whole effect of that is to generate that cavity structure in the equation for the waves. So that is where strong gravity is coming in. It's changing that potential. Instead of going off to minus infinity, it's now stopping at a finite. So that's the whole strong gravity effect.
My question is,
I don't think Event Horizon Telescope has a hope of seeing anything like that. LIGO is infinitely more sensitive to this effect.
Everybody also talked about this surface emission, that if there is a surface, then you could heat it up, and then there would be optical emission. I guess that's what he talked about. And I guess you probably want to say something about that why wouldn't there be surface emission?
Well, this is very close to being a black hole. So mm-hmm. once a particle falls in, it's essentially trapped because the escape cone is tiny, extremely tiny.
So you're saying it never gets out?
Particles that go in never get out, yeah.
I think so. The waves can, though.
Gravitational waves that are very low frequency and spherical, and because in that case, they go in and don't interact, so they can come out in the way they came in. But a particle going in will interact with something, and then it scatters into one of the high angular momentum states on the inside, mm-hmm. and that's the trapping. Yeah.
Yes.
So is there anything like specific to the theory that you're choosing, like which would cause these resonances in the halogen? I mean, is there any physical aspect that's like that one should consider to see these resonances like with inside the halogen?
What's the question?
I'm saying, is there any physical aspect of the halogen that would drive these resonances that you would see?
The only thing about the cavity that's important and that we're trying to measure is the size of the cavity.
Yeah.
So we saw it was given by the log of the ratio. So if you replace the Planck scale by something else, then the cavity could be much different in size.
My question was, what would cause these resonances? Because you can...
A cavity, by definition, has resonances. The waves in a cavity will have an evenly spaced resonance spectrum. We're just looking at a musical instrument here.
Derek? Is it conceivable to check whether perhaps the antipodes are involved? In other words, something will go in and bounces back, but not in the same spot, at the other pole, and then it goes back two ways. Could such fluctuations be recognized?
I was asking you at lunch that question, because this is sensitive to that type of thing.
I think you need to look at odd multipoles though for that, because even multipoles, they are the same for even multipoles. Would that be correct?
You instead of doing the L equal to...
you should do L equal to 3 to see that.
Yeah. But I think that's also possible.
Yes.
You seem to have focused on the fact that there are
the waveform is too complicated, but I have seen in several papers seen that the waveform is like a Gaussian path with a sinusoid. It's kind of simpler than what you have shown, but is that an effect of the initial condition that you found, or?
In those discussions, I don't see where they have considered the negative frequencies that I have. And that seems to be playing a role in getting more complicated waveforms.
Well, I don't know if that's why, but there are papers that consider Schwarzschild black holes that they say that they only show parts of the positive part of the frequency, but because this transfer function that you define would be symmetric in the Schwarzschild case and not no symmetric in KR, maybe they're considered something.
That's like that may be true. Schwarzschild may well be much more simple. Yeah, this is all Kerr.
Okay, my second question is, what motivated you to put the initial condition to have 10 pulses going back and forth inside the cavity? Are you trying to mimic something, or?
I think I had 100 pulses. Okay. I was just trying to mimic a completely random initial condition. Because I knew how to calculate things with individual pulses, so I can then just generalize that by putting in 100 of them, scattered all over the place with random amplitudes, just to try to model a more random initial condition.
Okay, but wouldn't it be better to do like a orbit or something around the black hole?
Okay, that's another point that I had to skip over. Everything here relies on the fact that the perturbation starts within the light ring, so within the cavity. I had one slide showing what happens when you have something coming in from the outside, and it's completely different. The whole resonance pattern is gone.
So I think actually maybe you're getting a bit late, and we're going to have a discussion at 4. So if you want the snacks to not disappear, probably we should go downstairs, and then we can continue more discussions regarding Bob's talk and all the previous talks after the break. So let's thank Bob again.